Thank you. My name is Myron Ebell. I work on this stuff from the political shoving and pushing end inside the Beltway at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. So I'm always pleased to get out of that milieu and deal with real issues like the ones on this paleoclimatology panel. And it's a very great honor for me to introduce my my longtime friend, whom I've learned so much from, Dr. Willie Soon. He is the Chief Science Advisor at the Science and Public Policy Institute, which is a rather new group run by Bob Ferguson in Washington that tries to actually bring scientific expertise to the very resistant members of Congress. Willie is an astrophysicist and geoscientist at the Solar, Stellar, and Planetary Sciences Division of the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. And I'm not going to go into his whole bio, but it's a very impressive one. And Willie has done some very important work in the field of the solar contributions to our Earth's climate over the years. And I've learned a huge amount from him, and I would ask you to join me in welcoming Willie Soon.
Thank you, Myron, and thank you all for coming. And thank you, Heartland Institute, for holding this conference, which I think is really important. And I'm glad that so many of these courageous scientists is really telling what is on their mind, and then bring forth the best scientific evidence that we do have to try to show that indeed the concern of all this rhetorical argument on global crisis caused by carbon dioxide is sort of beyond science. So good morning again. My name is Willie Soon, as introduced, and I'm both a solar physicist and a climate scientist who has been working day and night for the past 17 to 18 years just to quantify the role of atmospheric carbon dioxide, or CO2, in both the climate system and life as we know it. If there is one single message of my talk today, it is this. CO2 may be a secondary greenhouse gas, but it is certainly not the cause, quote, for the weather and climate we experience. And it is most certainly not any air pollutant in any sense of the word. Instead, we know that CO2 nourishes plant growth and can almost be sure that the 380 parts per million of CO2 concentration in the free air today is far below the optimal level for the growth of plants, especially for food production purposes. Let me now summarize for you the three key scientific points that I will cover today, which in turn will allow me to firmly suggest that it is impossible for anyone to insist that CO2 is an air pollutant, as the U.S. Supreme Court concluded around April 2nd of 2007 last year. So point number one, the repeated claim by the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, and its scientists, that the atmospheric CO2 level has not changed substantially during the last two millennia up to 1900 AD, and that the present CO2 level of 380 parts per million has never been exceeded for as long as the past 650,000 years, can both be shown to be false. And point number two, the level of atmospheric CO2 concentration are largely controlled by temperature and other biological and chemical factors rather than the other way around. This is, of course, very sharp contrast to the popular view that is suggesting simply more CO2 just mean more global warming. Such claim, of course, has been championed by the IPCC and our former Vice President Al Gore. And point number three, please remember this. There is no magical CO2 knob in the climate system that will provide a perfect climate for everyone, tuning it up or down. Instead, I will argue that the sun, which has no knob for micromanagement of United Nations or the Al Gore, unless I get a patent on it soon, that's of course, It's a more significant driver for temperature change than CO2, especially in the Arctic and Greenland area. I must make this very special emphasis that no magical CO2 control knob exists, because there is a widespread and almost dangerous belief in the popular press that if we just stop emitting this carbon dioxide from fossil fuel, then almost everything bad about the weather and climate system will suddenly become better. Instead, our active decision to combat global warming by cutting CO2 emission from fossil fuel will have virtually no effects on the global climate or on the frequency of bad weather events. Let me now introduce you to the first bright star of my talk this morning, the Western hemlock trees. The point I make here is that, in contrast to the impure or chemically altered air bubble records from the ice core, it is the planned response that may provide us with a much better record on how atmospheric CO2 has changed over time. Okay? Consider in this chart what the study of changes in the stomata property of Western hemlock tell us about how the atmospheric CO2 has changed over the past 2,000 years. The Western hemlock record shows large variation with both ups and downs in the atmospheric CO2 content. In sharp contrast, this result is very different from the popular view of the CO2 hockey stick painted by the data from ice core, where CO2 is essentially flat for the first 1900 years of pre-industrial period, and then a very sharp rise in the 20th century. So from the hemlock stomata CO2 data itself, I would conclude that the popular view of the IPCC is questionable at least on two counts. Count number one, the suggestions that the current level of 380 parts per million has never been exceeded at least since the past 650,000 years is clearly not correct, since this cannot be confirmed even for the last 2,000 years. Count number two, and more importantly, the idea that CO2 cannot change substantially until industrial revolution make fossil fuel combustion a reality is hard to accept and probably wrong. In other words, natural forces can shuffle quite a bit of the carbon between its land and ocean reservoir and the atmosphere over the past 2,000 years, as hinted by the Western hemlock record. Here is now a quick proof on how even the CO2 from the burning of fossil fuel cannot simply increase indiscriminately, but that the amount and the actual rate of increase of the atmospheric CO2, shown here as the blue curve from the burning of fossil fuel, will be tightly controlled by how warm or cold the atmospheric or ocean surface temperature itself, shown as the red curve. This is why even pioneers like the late Professor Charles David Keeling, despite being the 10th generation cousin of President George W. Bush through the common lineage of John and Mary Prescott, so there's no conspiracy here, was already warning everyone that a decade ago, projecting future level of atmospheric CO2 is not as simple as specifying the fossil fuel emission alone. So now let's consider this famous, what I call Al Gore's CO2 chart, showing the comparison between air temperature and carbon dioxide. Indeed, the former Vice President Al Gore has used this chart for almost 20 years now, as soon as the first result came out in 1987, to tell his audience that global warming is caused by rapid increase in CO2. But now note that the CO2, which is the blue curve, is closely related to the air temperature, the black curve shown here, over the past 650,000 years. But as I emphasize in the title of my chart, that the correct fact, and this is as concluded by the original authors of this ice core project, is that CO2 does not drive air temperature, but instead it is the temperature change that are responsible for the varying level of atmospheric CO2. But what has our former Vice President Al Gore say exactly about this CO2 and temperature relationship? In his famous book and movie, An Inconvenient Truth, he states that although the relationship is complicated, okay, that the bottom line is still that more CO2 simply means more global warming. Although Vice President Gore never really explained what that complication is, and you will hear more about this in the next view graph, he's only very quick to try to suppress any scientific challenge to his claim by invoking consensus argument. Such statement indicates that he believes social and political influences can trump science. The facts, however, clearly refute the former Vice President's assertion. The ice-core record clearly indicates that during the transitional period, where the climate emerged from an ice age to a warmer period, as shown in the fourth panel of this chart, the temperature always started to warm first by at least 600 to a few thousand years before the actual CO2 level started to respond. As Professor Bob Carter of James Cook University said, to accept Vice President Gore's kind of scientific argument is no different from insisting that lung cancer can cause cigarette smoking. So just remember that he's asking us to throw away the most holy principle of science, which is causality. Again, please do not take my word for it. There's no need. Just consider the very scientists that produced this ice core data. They make clear statement of how atmospheric CO2 varies naturally in direct response to the large temperature changes consistently for the last seven glacial termination times, or between the last seven transition between ice age and warm period for the past 650,000 years. Next, I want to dispel another widely held belief or misconception about the role of atmospheric CO2. This is very important because the point I'm about to make is not obvious even to some climate expert. First, a very clear, important disclaimer. Despite the very strong and unpleasant accusation noted in this quote from the Boston Globe, no one is trying to cover up deliberately or misrepresent the popular view of CO2 as an amplifier of global warming. It is simply the fact that the idea of CO2 as a major amplifier of the glacial-interglacial warming transition, or ice age to a warm period cycle, does not work if you study the data in details. For those of you who are interested, I have just recently published a paper that speaks more details about that particular point. So let us begin with this model simulation on how and why the very large and thick land-based ice sheets melted away from the last glacial maximum 21,000 years ago, shown in the left panels here, to the early warm Holocene period, 11,000 years ago, shown in the top right panel here. In this first simulation, atmospheric CO2 concentration were held constant at the low level of 200 ppm parts per million between cold ice age and warm Holocene. The only variable that changed is that the incoming solar radiation at high latitude of the northern hemisphere, which increased significantly as a result of changes in the orbit of the Earth about the Sun during the early Holocene, 11,000 years ago. So with stronger incoming solar radiation, most of the thick ice sheets over North America melted away, as seen on the top right panel here, and with significant thinning of the ice even over East Antarctica as well. Now, consider what happened to the ice sheet simulation of the early Holocene 11,000 years ago in a second experiment. Here, the incoming solar radiation is kept high as before, but now CO2, atmospheric CO2, is simultaneously increased by 80 parts per million to 280 parts per million at the early Holocene, as suggested by the ice core data we studied earlier. Comparing the very small difference between the top and the bottom results shows that the incoming solar radiation is a far more important and decisive factor than atmospheric CO2 in explaining why most of the ice sheets during the last glacial maximum melted away. The very large increase in the atmospheric CO2 by 80 parts per million has had very little effects on changes in the global ice volume. Even for the temperature measure itself, the role fight by the CO2 can explain no more than 30% of the glacial interglacial warming. So that's how small the role is of atmospheric CO2 is. For the final part of my talk, I want to focus now on the observed climate change over just the past 100 to 150 years. Here I offer evidence that CO2 is also not the prime driver of climate and climate variations, but instead, intrinsic changes in solar irradiance, as rooted in the magnetic field variations on the sun, are a more plausible and realistic driver for climate change over the Arctic. Consider next a rather important test of two different hypotheses on the observed Arctic temperature change, which I'll show in a minute. I focus on the Arctic region, since it has been called the canary in the coal mine when it relates to seeing or detecting the CO2 global warming signal, mainly because of the relatively large coverage of sea and land ice over the Arctic. The climatic response to increasing atmospheric CO2 is said to be extremely sensitive in the Arctic because of the ice albedo feedback, so that even a tiny initial melting of ice can allow more incoming solar radiation to be absorbed, which in turn will strongly amplify that small initial warming. Of course, if you are paying any attention, you will note that the ice albedo feedback works equally well for any small initial warming, regardless of the cause. This includes changes first induced by variations in the sun's irradiance. Okay, that's enough of a hint already. Here is now the Arctic surface temperature record for the last 40 years, given by the blue dotted curve. And also shown is the CO2 history, plotted as the red curve. Looking at such graph, some scientists from the IPCC have argued for a possible CO2 role in the Arctic warming seen over the most recent 40 years, especially from 1960s or so. But if we extend now the record back to the full 130 years of recorded history available, how can the equally prominent warming of the Arctic temperature for the 1930s to 1950 be explained? Or how can one even explain the cooling tendency between 1940s and the 1970s while the CO2 level is starting to rise rapidly? Now, the left panel shows a competing hypothesis to the idea of Arctic warming by CO2, the estimated solar irradiance history of over the last 130 years. Clearly, solar irradiance can better explain not only the warming for the most recent 30 years, but also the cooling from 1940s to 1970s, as well as the very large warming in the Arctic during the 1930s and 1950s from the cooler period of 1890s to 1900. From this result, I conclude that the sun is a better predictor of Arctic air temperature than CO2 concentration. Here is now another way to test my sun climate hypothesis. The historical temperature data from two coastal Greenland sites for the past 120 years are plotted as dotted blue curve in both top and bottom panels. Again, the solar irradiant curve is drawn in red to show the solar temperature correlation is also strong for smaller areas like Greenland as well. But how do we know that the above relationship haven't occurred simply by chance? In other words, how do we know that we have not fallen into the same trap as did former Vice President Gore in assuming that correlation equals causation? And can physics really tell us that the sun is indeed a bigger contributor to changes in the air temperature than CO2? Consider now the correct way of comparing the role of atmospheric CO2 forcing and that of the sun's radiation on the Earth temperature. In this chart, even the IPCC would agree that the sun's radiative forcing is a far more dominating factor for generating seasonal changes and therefore variations on even longer timescale of decades to century. But here we must consider both the baseline and the baseline plus change boundary conditions as the inseparable entity of what I call the weather and climate continuum. In other words, one cannot just pick and choose by insisting on looking at the difference in radiative forcing, since one must know the key meteorological and climatic processes that determine the mean climatology or the baseline first, before knowing how climate varies and changes. In this chart, the net forcing by carbon dioxide is about 1.7 watt per meter square, and indeed appears to be so much larger than the estimated net solar forcing of 0.2 watt per meter square. But again, I note that it is not the difference, but the overall magnitude of the forcing that is important. The changes in the sun's forcing results from the difference of a baseline that is at least a factor of 10 greater than the overall forcing of CO2, which is that 341 versus that 32 watt per meter square. And also, please note that as a solar astrophysicist, I do not agree with the value for the sun's net radiative forcing decided by IPCC. But for simplicity, allow me to use the IPCC figures as they also prove my point about the importance of the role of suns for weather and climate. To really see what I mean, let's consider a rough analogy. If one wants really want to compare 1 watt per meter square of solar radiation to 1 watt per meter square of CO2 radiative forcing, consider the effects of having Mr. William Refrigerator Perry of the NFL Chicago Bear teams from the mid-1980s, here representing the sun, trying to tackle the New England Patriots quarterback Tom Brady here as climate, and somebody asked me to change the slide to Eli Manning. I say, no way, Jose. And by contrast, note how ineffective it is for me, Willie Soon, representing CO2, the bad guy. Even if I manage to gain 1.7 pounds compared to the 0.2 pound gain by Big Refrigerator Perry, trying to push and force the climate system to cool or warm so decisively while ignoring a factor as big as the sun or the William Refrigerator Perry. Before I really finish off, I thought I'd entertain all the curious minds in the audience with this one final chart. If indeed, as I have shown and argued, that changing solar light output have a much stronger effect on the Earth's climate on timescale of several decades to century, then what do we know about how the sun's magnetism is going to vary in the near and far future? This final chart is essentially a teaser on what the sunspot number may change 170 years into the future, or until year 2180 AD or so. But as a scientist, I must emphasize that this is only a statistical game one can play. I will be the last one on Earth to insist that future climatic changes will result solely from a changing solar irradiance or other solar activity-related factors. But I think this one simple preview of the variable future of solar activity will be sufficient to give us a big hint that future change, especially over the Arctic and the Greenland area, will not be controlled by changing atmospheric CO2 alone. Indeed, this has been that one very simple point of my talk about things that we do know. CO2 is not in charge of all things weather and climate, not during the past, not at the present, certainly not in the future. I do want to end with a real positive note using the reminder from the mathematician and philosopher Alfred North Whitehead. Actually, I chose Whitehead's quote because he was incorrectly attributed as the author of Two Culture, which we know as C.P. Snow, by guess who? By our former Vice President Al Gore in his December 2006 speech on the crisis of global warming at the American Geophysical Union, where he gets some claps. But let's just focus on Whitehead's insight rather than Vice President Gore's series of mistakes as abundantly documented in this conference, especially through the work of Christopher Monckton in the lecture Apocalypse Now. So I recommend everyone to view that. And in case you are still worrying about CO2 causing catastrophic global warming in the near or far future, Professor Whitehead reminds us that it is the business of the future to be always dangerous, and it is among the merits of science that it equips the future for its duty. I hope that we can all agree that science has our most hopeful and reliable tool to rational decision-making, must never yield to social and political bias, as some scientists who are supported to study CO2 global warming idea tend to discount natural causes of climate change. And that will be all for my talk. Thank you.
Can the sun be explained for the warming of the winters versus the summers?
Oh, most certainly you can, because of the heat transport, the gradient. Remember, winter, the gradient is the largest, and in fact, it doesn't work by just direct radiative forcing. Oh, for sure, for Arctic especially.
I seem to remember about in a March 1983 issue of Nature, it was just a little chart that's from Greenland Ice Core studies that showed that 5,000 years before BP, that the CO2 concentration was around over 500 parts per million. And somehow that's disappeared. I look at the Nature archives and can't find it. Do you ever know anything about that study that was done in the 80s?
Yes, I know very well all those. In fact, I should talk to people in private. I can give a separate lecture on why I believe in that stomata CO2 results, because that's very critical argument. And you got to use that data very carefully, and I'll explain that in a minute, because the whole point is to show that the static level, because the IPCC really essentially asks you to believe this. Think about this. We have a lot of carbon, and they ask you to believe that over 2,000 years, that the level of CO2 changes can be no more than plus or minus 5 ppm. And to assume the whole system with forest fire, with huge biological productivity, would not be able to alter this atmospheric level of CO2 is very uncredible, not credible. That's the whole point. And I'll show more reasoning. In fact, I'll show you how they throw out both of the high peaks in the Sumatra data. You will be very, very surprised by this, by the way. I just don't have time to explain it. But the short answer is that they have seen it in ice core data, both of the peaks, and they threw the data away by simply the argument, this very simple argument, it cannot be. And that's the way we learn about science.
I believe one more quick question here. Was there another one over on this? Okay, we'll if you have other questions, we'll hope to have time.
You mentioned solar magnetic activity. Were you referring to the Svensmark theory? And second, just the second part of this is, To what extent is warming and cooling straight irradiance, changes in irradiance of the sun's heat energy versus magnetic phenomena?
The short answer is that I can discuss in lengthy discussion with you, because at around 2000, I'm also the leader in the front of studying these cosmic ray cloud ideas, but I gave up the idea completely. I can say it publicly. I can explain why. And the main mechanism that I propose, my hypothesis, is all irradiance. And that's all you need. Just think about the season. You start with the season and nothing more than that. And it's actually all the premises of that argument is as simple as something that if anybody know about Milutin Milankovitch ideas, and that's all it is. It's about all you need is a slight redistribution of sunlight and some sensitive latitude zone, which is the premise for this whole mechanism to work, and then tapping into the ocean circulation, the atmospheric heat transport. I have a whole bunch of very testable change of mechanism that I continue to write scientific papers on this, of course. And I have a whole bunch of evidence to support all the picture.
And if Bob Ferguson, we're going to stop questions now. Mike, we'll get to you later. If Bob Ferguson's still here, I want him to know I gave the Science and Public Policy Institute a plug at the beginning, and I want to give them another plug. There's a lot of Willy stuff, but there's a lot of other good stuff on their website. And in your packet, you will have seen the Christopher Monckton DVD, which was produced by Bob Ferguson and his institute. Now, our